Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to All Exits Closed. I'm Cynthia Pooler. My guest today is Harry Hawkins, who ran for president on the Green Party line in 2020. And he's here to discuss with me the vote for a union at Amazon and I forgot what southern state it was. So, Howie, give us a little background of what's going on with the union and Amazon.
Yeah, the vote was in Bessemer, Alabama. Bessemer is a suburb of Birmingham. Pardon me?
Okay.
Yeah, Alabama.
Okay. Right.
And
go ahead.
The vote was officially 71% to 29% voting down the union. But the company got about 500 ballots thrown out. So if those were probably mostly pro-union votes, it may have been closer to 60-40. But it's still a pretty decisive defeat. And, you know, people are doing their postmortems. A lot of people think that maybe they moved too quickly on the union vote. It was what they sometimes call a hot shop campaign. The workers initiated it when Amazon opened up there last year in the middle of the pandemic. And a lot of these are mostly black workers, and sort of the Black Lives Matter movement came into the shop and they said, we want a union. But the company kept hiring. So when they, you know, started organizing the union, they had less than 2,000 workers. By the time the vote came, there were 6,000 workers. So the company was able to have these mandatory meetings with workers against the union, and that made it difficult. So, you know, some critics say they should have taken longer time, but the horse was sort of out the barn. They'd already, you know, collected the signatures and said, we want an election. So it that's sort of the background to where they got where they at. Now, the union has filed a bunch of complaints with the National Labor Relations Board for labor law violations by Amazon. That may lead to another election down the road, but it's a difficult situation. Amazon is a huge company, and they're hiring all over the country and expanding their warehouses. So I think this is just the first shot in a long war.
So, you know, during the pandemic, Jeff Bezos has made a killing, you know, because people don't go out to stores, so they went online, they purchased stuff on Amazon online. So Jeff Bezos benefited tremendously, you know, on the vote. What did he ever say why he's against the unions in his organization?
I haven't heard of any public statements, but obviously the less he pays his workers, the more money goes to the shareholders. So, you know, the company's workers organize to collectively bargain. So there's no surprise there.
So, you know, unions are not as much of a force as they have been in the past, and the numbers are dwindling and dwindling and dwindling. And does the Amazon vote, is that a foretaste of what's to come, or do you think at some point there might be a great push for unions to organize, for workers to organize in unions, and for unions to have more of a say in the workplace?
Well, we know from public opinion polling that support for unions, you know, workers who want to be in unions, is at a high point. It's over 60%. So that tells you the ground is fertile. The problem is the terrain on which we organize is very difficult because of the way they enforce labor laws. You know, if you get the majority of people to sign a petition or sign up cards for the union and force an election, right now the elections are not timely. They're dragged out, which gives the company time to organize against the union. And, you know, there are other things like they can hire replacement workers. They can fire union organizers with impunity. So the threat of that overworkers, and, you know, they say down there in Bessemer, they put a mailbox right at the, you know, outside the company door and encourage workers to vote there, which made workers feel like the company was watching how they voted. They had the ballots right there for them. So there's all that kind of intimidation that goes on. And so it's got more and more difficult for unions to organize. Now, there's a bill before Congress called the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, or PRO Act, which would change a lot of that. In right-to-work states, if you get a contract, it would require the organized workers to pay dues, which in right-to-work states they don't have to do even if you're organized. The law would limit one of the practices a lot of companies do of making people who are really employees independent contractors, so they aren't covered by labor law. You know, Uber does that. FedEx does that with its drivers and so forth. This PRO Act would prohibit these mandatory employer anti-union meetings. It would have quicker elections or even a card check recognition. In other words, when a majority sign a petition or a card, they want a union, then you go to collective bargaining. And then it would require the company bargain in good faith, or there'd be mandatory mediation, and if that doesn't work, binding arbitration, to get a contract. Right now, a lot of times unions are voted in and then the company stalls and they never get a contract. It would prohibit permanent striker replacements. It would legalize something the Taft-Hartley Act made illegal back in 1946, and that is secondary boycotts. So if there's a company that has influence over the employer you're trying to organize, you could boycott or picket that company and put pressure on the employer you're trying to organize. So a lot of these things are in this PRO Act, and some other things as well that Biden could do by executive order. He hasn't. One of them is a neutrality rule, which means that employers who are getting federal contracts would have to be neutral on a union organizing drive. Amazon has lots of federal contracts. You know, Biden could have done that by executive order. There's another rule, the persuader rule, which was thrown out a while back. Obama had it in. Trump got it thrown out. Biden could have put it back in, which requires companies to disclose all the spending they're doing on anti-union organizing. You know, right now, you only have to disclose payments to people who actually talk to the workers. But most of these payments go to, you know, legal firms that advise on how to resist the union, and that's not disclosed. And then another thing Biden could do is, and it's actually in the American Jobs Plan, is, the neutrality rule would be in the American Jobs Plan. But another thing Biden could do is, in the American Jobs Plan, only give contracts for the infrastructure spending that's in it to companies that are organized, have a union, a collective bargaining agreement. So there's a lot that can be done on the legal side, but then on the union side, you know, unions have become, you know, more service organizations than organizing organizations. In other words, you get a contract, and then they provide the services that are in the contract, you know, the pension, the health care, if they have a pension, and grievance, you know, dealing with grievances. So the union kind of gets focused on that and doesn't do organizing. So the unions have lost a lot of their ability to organize, and including conducting strikes. So I think from, you know, the the public policy end, we can change the terrain in which unions organize. But then the labor movement itself has to take a more organizing approach rather than just being service organizations.
What percentage of Americans have pensions? What percentage of people who are in the workforce today can look forward to having a pension when they retire?
I don't remember the numbers, but it's very small and much smaller than it used to be. So a defined benefit pension is a rarity these days. I mean, in the private sector, barely 6% of workers are organized, and most of them don't have defined benefit pensions. They have what they call defined contribution pensions, which are basically 401k. So the risk is on the worker. You know, they invest in, you know, stocks and bonds through the 401k, but if the, you know, the securities are down, tough luck for the worker. In a defined benefit pension, you have a defined benefit you get when you retire, and it's the pension fund's responsibility to, you know, make sure that the asset and income is sufficient to cover those pensions.
So what you're telling me is, you know, as people retire today, the standard of living of these people are going to continue to go downward because they only, if they never invested in a pension a plan for retirement, all they have would be their Social Security, right?
Right. And the defined benefit pensions, you know, that's part of your collective bargaining agreement. So part of the total compensation is the company puts money in the pension fund. So you're not personally responsible for picking stocks and bonds like you are in these 401k type plans, the defined contribution plans. So, you know, larger number of companies have those, but a lot of people are living paycheck to paycheck, so they don't put money in those, you know, personal investments. So there's 401k. In addition to that, you can get, you know, tax favorable individual retirement account, and, you know, is another way to invest in your retirement. But most people don't do that because they're barely getting by with the wages they're getting.
You know, Henry Ford was quite a controversial figure. But the one thing, you know, that I think is good is he paid his wage workers enough money so that they could afford to buy a car. Today, employers, they want to continue to have their workers decrease their standard of living. And between younger people with the student loan debt and with older people with no pensions, we're looking at generations of poverty-stricken people. Would you agree?
Yeah. But, you know, basically about half of the people in the country are a paycheck away from being in poverty if they're not already there. So, and because people lose jobs and things happen, they get a medical bill, a lot of people are in and out of poverty over the course of time. So, yeah, about half the population is in poverty or, you know, just above it. And, you know, that consumer demand is not in the economy, but the economy keeps going because, you know, the upper middle and upper income people do spend a lot, and, you know, companies then, the market then caters to their needs. So it doesn't stop the economy, but it's not benefiting the working class.
So when you heard on the news the vote for unionization in the Amazon thing, were you surprised at the amount of people who voted it down?
No, because I've been reading reports about the organizing. And look, in Alabama, you know, $15 an hour, where a lot of people are making much less, the minimum wage is $7.25, is a pretty good job. And the thing, you know, a lot of these workers don't understand, many of them are young. The job is very physically demanding. And so the young people can cut it, but over the long haul, you know, they're not going to be able to maintain that pace. And so, you know, they're looking at the short term. But the company was very effective at saying, look, you're getting, you know, $15 an hour and some benefits. That's better than most jobs around here. And they would then say, you know, you're putting that at risk if you vote the union, because the union's going to take dues money from you. That was a big thing Amazon said. And, you know, we're going to, and then Amazon will say, look, we're talking to you. We're going to take care of you. So the fact that the union was organizing, you know, management, mid-level management, you know, was talking to the workers saying, we're going to take care of you. So that seemed to have persuaded a lot of the workers who, you know, particularly the new hires who hadn't been there at the start when the company, you know, opened up the warehouse, and a lot of those workers said, we need a union. So that was kind of the dynamic. You know, some people have criticized them. They call them hot shop campaigns, where, you know, the people in the shop say, we want a union, and it seems like everybody, you know, majority want it, and so they move quickly. Some of the criticism has been, you know, particularly given that Amazon was increasing the workforce and bringing on lots of new people, they should have taken more time to build a really strong organizing committee and not move to get a union vote until they knew they had a majority of people, which would have taken longer. But it was the, you know, workers who initiated this. As I think I mentioned, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement, you know, a lot of these people were acting in the spirit of that, and they wanted to move right away. So the union was kind of, you know, stuck with that timeline. So, you know, the people down there are going to have to think about, you know, what their next steps are, particularly if their complaints filed with the National Labor Relations Board leads to a new election.
So over the, you know, you've been organizer and a political person for many, many years. Over the years, you've seen unionization dwindle. When did that start? Did that start with Reagan or before?
It accelerated with Reagan. It started before. I mean, he gets credit for the firing of the PATCO workers, the air traffic controllers. But actually the plan to fire those workers was developed in the Carter administration. And in that recession from 1973 to 75, the employers decided they were going to go on an offensive. And in that period, we began to see the movement of shops, you know, first from the north to the south, which have these right-to-work laws, and then to overseas. And so that accelerated in the 80s, continued in the 90s, and has continued to this day. And so that put unions on the defensive. So rather than, you know, fighting for improvements, they were fighting against concessions. And I think also, you know, the period from the end of World War II to about 1970 or 1973, unions were able to get improvements with every contract. Wages were increasing in line with productivity. And so I think they kind of got lulled to sleep and thought they had a partnership with the employers. And after that recession in 73, 75, the employers went on the offensive. And the unions, I think, were caught flat-footed and have been on the defensive ever since.
Why do you think a number of people are not in favor of being in a union shop?
Well, I mean, the public opinion polls say the majority of people do. Those that don't tend to be people that think, you know, I'm solely responsible for my, you know, economic well-being, and I don't need to collectively bargain. I don't need a union. I can handle this myself, which I think, you know, is an ideology that, you know, gets pushed. You know, you advance within a so-called free market. You know, I worked at UPS. I think they have about 2 million employees. It's a huge company. I think I was a lot better off having, you know, the Teamsters and you know, collectively bargain on behalf of all of us than me as an individual, you know, try to bargain with the company for, you know, wage increases and benefit improvements. So, so I think a lot of people think they can do it on their own, but I think that's a delusion.
So, you just mentioned UPS, which employs, you know, many people throughout the United States. Are big employers for the most part? Do they have unions or no?
UPS is the largest company in the private sector with a union. And it's, I forget, you know, it's like one of the top five, maybe the top three employers. So, but then you can go to other large companies like Walmart, like Amazon, that don't have unions. So most of the unions, I mean, the public employee unions, I think they're around, trying to remember, like 15% of public employees are organized. So they're doing better, but large employers, you know, it's really hard to take on a big company, particularly if they got rid of the unions. I mean, back in the 50s, over a third of the workforce was organized, and it tended to be, you know, the large corporations, the industrial corporations. But things have changed. A lot more people work in the services. A lot of those industrial plants have moved overseas. And, you know, so that's part of the reason why the proportion of private sector workers are not in unions today.
Ultimately, what do you say? What do you think the outcome is going to be for the fact that big employers are fighting against unions?
Well, I think it depends on two things. One is if this PRO Act can get passed through Congress, that will make it easier to organize. And I think the bigger factor is if the labor movement can become more focused on organizing and not just servicing their existing members. And, you know, unions are smaller proportion of the workforce than they used to be, but they still bring in something like $12 billion a year in dues from their members. You know, that's a budget that can be used to organize. And so I think a lot depends on what the labor movement does.
Wow. So the labor movement in this country, would you say it was dwindling?
Yeah, it's been dwindling, you know, since the 50s, you know, in terms of the proportion of workers who are organized. It's kind of stabilized the last few years around 6% of the private sector. But I think, you know, there's plenty of room for expansion. And, you know, I say the labor movement and generally criticize it for having a service model rather than an organizing model. But it varies from union to union. You know, some of the unions are much more aggressive in organizing than others. So it depends on the union and the sector they're organizing in.
So what have you been up to since 2020 and the election?
Well, we've continued to advocate for the policies we campaigned on, and we do a weekly podcast, and I've been writing some articles and speaking on programs like this, doing interviews. So pretty much it's like I'm still campaigning, but I'm not actually running for an office. We're campaigning for the issues.
So do you think the Green Party will have a future in 2024?
Oh, yeah, the Green Party will be here. You know, we face some real obstacles. For example, the presidential primary matching funds program. If this For the People Act passes, as it's currently written, it would increase fivefold the amount of money we have to raise to qualify for those matching funds, which the major party candidates haven't been using pretty much since 2000. You know, it's really the Green Party that's been the only party that qualified for that. So they're increasing from $5,000 raised in small contributions from 20 states to a new standard of $25,000 raised in 20 states. And they're trying to induce the major party candidates back into that public funding program by saying you don't have to limit your private spending if you accept this public money. So in 2020, for example, if you accepted the primary matching funds, you couldn't spend more than $52 million on your primary, which for the major party candidates, they wanted to spend a lot more than that, so they didn't try to get the public funding. For the Green Party, you know, it made a big difference for our campaign. So that's one thing, and the other thing is they are making it harder to get on the ballot. We know that in New York. They tripled the number of votes we needed to stay on the ballot and doubled the frequency, and we came up short in 2020. To get back on, we got to get triple the signatures we used to have to get by independent nominating petition from 15,000 to 45,000 in basically 5 weeks, which is a hell of a job. And there was just a law proposed in Nevada to double the signatures. They did pass a law in Arkansas to increase the signatures required. So, you know, their laws passing, some led by Democrats like Nevada because they don't want the Greens on the ballot, some led by Republicans like in Arkansas because they don't want the Libertarians on the ballot because they feel that, you know, these third parties are taking votes from them. So, you know, we have real challenges. But that, you know, we're going to do the best we can because the policies we're advocating are not going to be adopted by the Democrats and Republicans. So we have no choice.
If anybody wants to hear what you're doing, I know you're on Facebook once a week. How can anybody hear what you're doing or even contact you?
Well, they should go to the campaign website, howiehawkins.us, and then we have another one, greensocialist.net. One of the things we've organized after the campaign is a Green Socialist Organizing Project to work with this new socialist movement and people in the Greens who want to advance those kind of politics. So both those websites, people can find out what we're saying when we're online, you know, with these podcasts. And they're archived, so you don't have to listen to them live.
Okay, great. So, Howie, I'm sure that we will talk again soon. You've been listening to Howie Hawkins, who was the Green Party candidate for president in 2020. I'm Cynthia Pooler. This is All Exits Closed. If you like this show, follow us on Twitter. Thanks, Howie. We'll talk again, and thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a great day.